there are all these parenting groups online on places like Facebook, and I've been scanning them for this piece. I'm trying to get a better sense of the questions parents most often have. I wanted to know if there were trends in the types of dilemmas parents face, at least in the ones they're willing to post about online. And it turns out there are kind of. My analysis of reading through these posts were that it seems like they're full of mostly well-intentioned parents who are asking a lot of questions that are very practical in nature. How do you find a good doctor? How communicative should you expect the teacher to be? And the responses are a mix. Some are definitely helpful. Many feel preachy, some self-righteousness that feels like it's trying to jump off the screen and slap you in the face for being so painfully uninformed. And every once in a while, there's a very real, honest question that pops up. It feels very vulnerable. Kind of like the person didn't know where else to go, and so they ended up in this online forum somehow, hoping to figure out how to move forward. And so I found one of those posts in a group that I wanted to share here. I had a group of actors recreate this online thread using pseudonyms. Here it is.
Why is my son doing this? Sebastian Willem. I need help from this group. When my son was 3, we had a terrible experience with an at-home daycare he was at. Long story short, the provider had 2 older sons who it turned out were being very aggressive with and bullying the young children. The provider denied it up and down, but ultimately enough parents came together to share the stories and we realized what was going on. The facility was reported and it was shut down. You can imagine the anger and the guilt that came from the whole situation, but we moved on and we thought we put the whole thing in the past. Fast forward now 5 years later. My son is now 8 years old and is displaying behavior that I believe is connected to this event. He has become very close with a neighborhood child who is older and, from what I can see, treats my son horribly. I've personally witnessed him calling him names, stealing toys, and on a couple of occasions, even shoving. Each time I've talked with my son about why this is unacceptable, and he seems to understand. However, he still wants to play with his neighbor daily, even though there are so many other children in the neighborhood, closer to my son's age. The other day, a family member asked my son who his best friend was, which is a question I purposely never asked. I think it's because I knew how he'd answer. I physically shuddered when he said the neighborhood boy's name. I'm torn because I'm not sure if I should get more involved. Part of me wants to forbid my son from playing with his friend. Am I overreacting? What should I do?
Melissa Gage Metcalf. Bullying creates a lasting impact. At 8 years old, your son may not understand the effect peers like this will have on him down the line. It's hard to know how connected this is to past experiences. But either way, you're not obligated to allow your son to choose his own friends at this age. You, as the parent, know what's best for him.
Ken Metzger. He may be unconsciously recreating his past experience. We're drawn to the familiar as humans. This even applies to children.
Sue Kelly. You're likely overanalyzing this based on your own trauma reaction to the past event. Nothing you mention above is particularly abnormal in childhood friendships. If your son enjoys playing with the neighbor child, trying to force him into different directions will be unlikely to be successful anyway. It'll likely just cause you both frustration. Childhood is about learning and growing. Allow your son this experience without this type of constant analysis. Honestly, I suggest giving your son more space to play with his friend rather than torturing yourself by supervising too closely.
Melissa Gage Metcalf. You're suggesting he should not intervene when he's witnessing bullying?
Sue Kelly. I'm saying what is happening here is probably not bullying.
Ken Metzger. Name-calling, stealing toys, and shoving by an older child are bullying behaviors. I don't see how you're suggesting this is acceptable. Do you acknowledge the long-term psychological impact this type of treatment can have on children? Childhood bullying raises the probability of depression, anxiety, suicidality, and overall well-being. We shouldn't be turning a blind eye to this type of behavior.
Sue Kelly. Children, even the older child in this scenario, is obviously still learning about things like appropriate relationship dynamics and emotional regulation. If you watch closely and apply adult standards of relationships to children, you'll always see behavior that looks to be over the line, We too often label this behavior as bullying when it's actually just normal childhood interactions. Children are self-centered and can be rude, sometimes downright disrespectful. It's part of their normal development. Sure, at some points this crosses the line and adult intervention is needed, but most of the time it isn't. The father here is the only one who has enough information to decide how to move forward.
Melissa Gage Metcalf. I think the key here is the extent and consistency of the name-calling, toy-stealing, and shoving. If it's happened once or twice over a long period of supervised time, sure, let that go. If it's a pattern, the father needs to intervene.
Sebastian Willman. Thanks, all. I tend to watch their interactions very closely, closer than an 8-year-old would normally be supervised. The shoving has only happened once. The name-calling and toy-stealing have happened a bit more, but I've also seen my son take toys from the neighborhood child, so it's hard to know.
Ken Metzger. This may or may not be at the threshold of bullying. I'd continue to watch their interactions closely and intervene as you feel it's needed.
Sue Kelly. I disagree. It sounds like your son is fully capable of navigating this on his own. Let them play.
My name is Tobin Richardson. I'm a counselor educator with the vision to save the therapist by creating a forever free podcast style platform designed for learning. And here, learning about trauma informed parenting as it applies to therapists who work with children and their families. I think most notably, I think about this topic as it applies to those working within the foster care system. But of course, it's impossible not to apply this to ourselves and families we know in our personal lives as well. Talking through this topic is Trish Jonker, who's a therapist who has spent most of her career working with foster families, and probably more importantly, has herself fostered 8 children. As you can imagine, this personal experience taught her about trauma-informed parenting in a way that a textbook or a course never could, in a way that's been enlightening and humbling and rewarding. And now she shares her insights with therapists on the topic whenever she can. Here she is.
So I wondered if you could maybe kind of just kick us off by talking about your story and kind of like where your interest in this topic began.
Yeah, I definitely have a unique journey into this story. Essentially, I graduated and started off bouncing around in a few different careers. Well, not careers, but in the mental health licensed counselor field. Spent a fair bit of time in nonprofit community mental health, where many of us have started out. And I'll be very honest with you, it was during that time that I really thought, like, wow, I would never do foster care or adoption because it just seems really, really hard. And there seems to be a lot of emotional and behavioral struggles that these families are going through. And but then over time, keeping a very long story short, I ended up in my personal life right around the age of 40, actually, finding out about some kiddos that needed a place to stay. And so I found myself at the age of 40, we invited 5 kids to come live with us. And they were age 9, 10, 11, 15, and 16. So I really thought that I would be pretty good at it because I thought, well, I've been a therapist for a few years now and I know a lot about trauma-informed care and this will be great. And I quickly became fully immersed in that world of really trying to support these kiddos to help them be as successful as possible while struggling with some of the pain that they had been through both physically and emotionally. And so, where I am today, I've now been a therapist for about 20 years. I've been a foster parent for about 12 years. And I really enjoy talking about how to blend those two worlds where we can take the psychological interventions, the evidence that we have, the research that's been done, while at the same time really looking at the realistic situations for families like mine. I'll be honest with you, I think in my particular situation, we were also a transracial family. And so all of the children, we've had 8 children in our home and all of them have been African-American and I'm Caucasian. And so quite honestly, that was a piece I thought I'd be fine with, as many of us who are Caucasian and we go into these situations thinking that we can help. That was when I really made some mistakes on, especially early on, and really had to, you know, it's almost a second layer of trauma for them, where they're coming out of an African-American community and they came into, and we did try to put them in diverse school systems, but let's be honest, you know, our house is still very white. And so there was another level there of trauma for them, of missing their community, of missing certain cultural aspects, certain foods, you know, different things like that, that then I did play catch up 2 or 3 years into it, where I realized I was making a big mistake there and really tried to educate myself on that front and apologize and make some shifts.
Can you talk a little bit more about like what the process was like of trying to do this in a trauma-informed way? Like, what were some of the things that you maybe thought about at the beginning or turned out to be the most trauma-informed practices that you think were really beneficial?
Well, I have become a very big believer in integrative strategies and really looking at the whole body. So for example, movement, I don't love the word exercise. I think it's a tough one for a lot of people. So I often say the word movement. But just, you know, for many of these kids, talking about their trauma can be really difficult. Especially in the foster care system, where they continue to have visits. They continue to go back to the home, maybe where the trauma occurred. They continue to interact in a supervised manner, most likely, but still it's very difficult when they're still living in both worlds. And so movement became a big one for me, where I really encouraged the kids to, go for a walk. You know, our oldest, he would often go for walks, and just he found it much more calming and could settle him down, and he could go to sleep just by walking. We had kind of a rule in our house, and it's not super strict, but we really expected that all of our kids were in some type of an activity and they could choose what that looked like. But we really wanted it to be something where they were moving their body. Could be dance, could be tumbling, could be tennis, could be basketball, high jump, whatever it was, so that they could work out some of that tension that they were holding. In addition to that, things like trying to incorporate nutrition, really trying to work on their sleep and regulating their sleep patterns, which were all over the place. And doing it in a gracious, kind of slow way. I'm always very sensitive when I talk to families about nutrition, because food is comfort. So if a kiddo has just moved into your house this week, get them all the comfort foods they want. If you're a therapist working with a family and they've just, you know, invited a kiddo into their house, you know, I often use the comparison of coffee. You know, imagine that your house burned down and Red Cross came and said, hey, one of your neighbors is willing to let you live with them. And you're like, oh my gosh, that's so great. And you go there, and the morning you wake up and you've just been through one of the worst days of your life. And you come down to the kitchen and you're like, hey, does anybody have any coffee? And they're like, oh no, we find coffee and caffeine to be too stimulating and too acidic on our systems, and we prefer green juices in the morning. And you're like, today is not the day that I'm going to skip my coffee. And that's how it is for our kids when they come into our homes. The first couple of days, the first couple of weeks is not the time to make those healthy shifts. We really want to just give them comfort. But then slowly over time, kind of introducing, whether it's through supplementation or through, you know, soups and broths, or, you know, ways that you can get nutrient dense foods. I love to like cut up strawberries and leave them in a bowl on the counter, and within an hour they're gone, right? Because they're just out there, they're visible, they're bright, they're colorful, and kids will just start snacking on fruit, and then we're getting some more nutrients into their bodies. So those are some big ones for me. And then I would also add, from more of a clinical side, really looking at some of the DBT skills, really learning, you know, to ride the wave, and being able to tolerate some of those more explosive kind of experiences that they're going through, and teaching them some coping skills to kind of help out with that distress tolerance.
As a therapist who's also a foster parent, do you feel like they're like, was it hard for you to separate those two? Did you find yourself like in therapist mode a lot? Like, with your kids, or do you still, or does it really feel like two separate like parts of you, you know?
That's a really interesting question. I think at the beginning I was really in therapist mode, a bit of a messiah complex, if I'm being honest, and just really trying to get in there and save the day. And I knew what to do. I was a professional at this, and you know, I can coach you through these situations. And then, like I said, you know, give it a couple of years and my humility kind of kicked in, and I realized I needed to also be myself and to slow down. So I think I would never by any means say I'm honestly, I wouldn't say I'm a great foster parent. I'm the world's most okayest foster parent. Like, I need that mug, right? We're all just doing the best we can. And I think it now flows a little bit more naturally between the two. One thing I think we really tried to bring into our house was humor, and just that ability to break the stress cycle by a good belly laugh and just kind of having fun and not always taking it so seriously. And when we mess up, we mess up, both kids and us, and just trying to, flow a little bit more between those two instead of putting so much pressure on myself, I think, which I think for therapists working with foster parents, I think there's a lot of that. There's a lot of pressure that foster parents feel, and adoptive parents, I would include in that as well. A lot of our friends will say, wow, you're so amazing. Oh, you're a saint. You're so great. And you don't feel like it half the time because you just really messed up at home. And so I think having that grace both for yourself and for others is really important.
Yeah. Like, I wonder if, cause you mentioned like you kind of went into it with the savior complex. I imagine if you can't drop that to some extent, it would be very difficult to do long term.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a good awareness for anyone working in the space with foster and adoptive parents is that giving them a safe place to be a screw up, and and that's true with any parent. Anybody who's parenting is going to screw up. And so just encouraging that safe space. Because I think especially in the foster and adoption world, because everybody else puts you on that pedestal, it becomes a smaller circle of people that you can be honest with about how hard it is. And many times you're experiencing tougher behaviors at home and emotions at home. You know, there's a line, people always say this to me, but they'll say like, oh, I could never be a foster parent. Like, I could never give them back. Like, once they were done being fostered, if I had to say goodbye, I could never do it. And there is no foster parent that's excited about that part. We also have depression in those moments where the kids leave us. And so it's not that we're special. It's not that we're cold-hearted that we can give these kids away. But it's part of the gig, and we're in it because we believe in the love that's needed in those in-between moments when they were taken away from their home and wherever they go when they leave us. And so it's just allowing us to be able to say, no, like, that is really hard for me. No, this part is really hard for me. I had somebody say to me once after one of our kids moved out and went back to their biological parent, I was really depressed about it. I was really struggling. And this person said, but you knew that was going to happen. I was like, well, yeah. And it's hard.
Yeah.
And to have space where you can have those feelings, all those complicated emotions, is really important.
Yeah. I'm wondering about, okay, so if you were advising a therapist who is working with foster parents, but had not been a foster parent, so it's because it sounds like there's some like maybe well-meaning, but like off base comments. It sounds like foster parents make you get sometimes.
Yes.
What else do you think that therapist needs to know as far as like what to avoid or how to support those parents directly?
Yeah. I think I would go back to like counseling 101 of just being very neutral in the room, but in the sense of like when they make a comment about I'm a foster parent, I would not lead with a wow statement of any kind, but just okay, and tell me more about that. Just like you would if they said they were a second grade teacher or whatever. Like we don't want to give any kind of emotion to their current situation. We just want to say, okay, and tell me more about that. And how is that going for you? And what you love about it and what's really hard about it. And just leading with those neutral questions so that you can get a sense of what stage they're in. Because they might be in a stage where it is going really well and they are really excited. And maybe they're looking at a possibility of adoption for this child and they are really happy. So you don't want to assume it's hard. And at the same time, if they are really struggling, you want to make sure you create that safe space where they can be honest with you and not feel judged for any of the thoughts or feelings they're having about the situation or the child or whatever. And then there's a whole spectrum in the middle that we're constantly floating in and out of. So I think really giving that space to do a full assessment of where they're at and what they need from you and reflecting that back to them.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And what about, as I think about the topic of trauma-informed parenting, I'm wondering if there are nuances to children within the foster care system, or if when you think of trauma-informed parenting, it's kind of just like best practices across the board of children who have been through trauma.
Yeah. I think I see so many similarities. You know, I worked with a family where their child had had open heart surgery as a newborn. And so they didn't have that skin to skin contact. That baby's chest was open, I think they said, for 3 days, you know. So there's all kinds of early childhood trauma that impacts the emotion regulation system of a young child. When you look at ACEs, right? So for sure, if somebody's been through foster care, you can check that box and say we're doing trauma-informed parenting. But I think there's also a whole host of other early childhood traumas that even biological parents should be aware of. And I think some of the toughest parts is the behaviors that we see in kids because they don't necessarily have words to express what they're feeling. So we end up maybe seeing internalizing or externalizing behaviors. And what we really want to do is have that sense of grace that this is not oppositional defiance is one of my least favorite phrases. Because they didn't wake up in the morning hoping to get in trouble, right? These are kids that are good kids. They wake up in the morning really wanting to do well in school, really wanting to impress the people that are around them, but something happens and they have a response to it. And that then ends up getting them in trouble with their parents or teachers or whomever. And I often compare it to any other kind of disability where, just like with adults with trauma, you know, they're having this emotional response, but they can't give you the words as to why. And so being very flexible in terms of things like consequences. So, you know, with the school system, if you're doing an IEP for your kid, really looking at what are the strategies that actually work to shape and change this child's behavior. I would suggest my first go-to is probably going to be around connection. That when they are starting to get escalated, they're probably going to need safe space with a trusted adult that's on staff. They're not going to do well with an in-school suspension where they're going to have to sit in the principal's office and sit at a desk and do work, you know? So it's really trying to be creative around what can we do to actually support this child and teach them some emotion regulation skills that really help them to become stronger as opposed to traditional discipline. I would say you can try the traditional discipline. And I forget the stats right now, maybe you can get them later, but traditional discipline does not work for kids that have been through early childhood trauma. It does not change or shape the behavior, but a lot of school systems and parents still keep trying to do it. They, for example, send the kid to their room. Well, that's it. You know, you were rude at dinner, so you're going to have to go to your room and you can stay there until bedtime with no electronics. And that worked for me when I was a kid because I didn't experience any of those things. But for some of our kids, they've now experienced shame and rejection, which often ties back to their trauma. And now they're isolated and alone. And especially with the foster care system, very, very often, the vast majority of cases, the trauma was occurred through a relationship. There was a relationship that went in the wrong direction, either sexual abuse, physical abuse, et cetera. So we need to heal that through relationship. So we need to teach them what safe relationships look like. We need to teach them that they are important and they are loved and they have strengths and that we see them. And some of those traditional disciplinary tactics don't work and may even actually make things worse. I'm a big fan of meeting the child where they're at. And so, you know, it's like, I always say play therapy doesn't change just because the kid's now 6 feet tall, right? So if I've got a kid that really loves basketball, I'm going to go outside and I'm going to shoot hoops with them on the driveway, even though I'm a 5'2" Canadian girl, because I'm going to play alongside them. And that play, as we're next to each other, engaging in a similar activity, especially where they have mastery and enjoyment, is going to help them regulate. And then once I've been able to co-regulate with them, then I can get into a conversation about, dude, what was that at dinner? What was that all about? And another key thing in that conversation is I don't say, you're such a rude kid, or I don't label them as the behavior. I just say, I was really surprised by that behavior because you're not a rude kid. You're such a good person and I love having you here. So I was just kind of surprised. What was that all about? And so kind of going through those conversations can then help me be a safe place for them to say, well, I didn't like it when you said blah, 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 which is probably going to be something I didn't even realize triggered them. And then we can kind of come back to, I can apologize for it. Now I know it triggered. Now we can go back. But if I just go and send him to his room and consequence him, I'm never going to get that information. Some people get a little too serious about it all. And I think when you can have those moments of movement and laughter and kind of getting everything out, I think sometimes we get really stuck on, well, you have to tell me all your terrible stories and you have to sit in the chair and you have to talk to me about all your terrible stories. And sometimes it's just letting them know that there are safe adults in the world that are kind and gracious and playful and safe to be around that can be incredibly healing for their worldview. And many of us as adults will look back, and if we talk to you about significant adults from our past, they weren't people that talked to us about our life. They were people who were playful and kind and gracious that made us laugh. And so being that type and holding that space for those kids, I think is really important.
Trauma-informed parenting is a topic that I think beyond most others in the mental health field, feels really personal and almost sensitive. And I think it's because we intuitively know that children are so precious and vulnerable, and especially us as helping professionals, we just want to do right by them so desperately. And then simultaneously, there are so many different parenting styles and parenting experts, saying that word in air quotes, sometimes with such vastly different philosophies that it can feel overwhelming, almost stop us in our tracks. But both in my conversation with Trish, as well as just in exploring the research on my own, there were themes that did jump out as very clear best practices. And they were things like establishing safety above all else, and then building trust and cultivating empowerment and emotional regulation. And of course, these aren't things that happen overnight. Sometimes it can feel like they're not happening at all. Children have a way of humbling adults. And so I love that Trish, even with all her experience and impact in this field, she acknowledged this. She doesn't always feel like she's doing this work perfectly, or sometimes even well, but she keeps these principles in the forefront of her work. So she is, I know she is. And at the end of the long and winding road, she'll see it too, probably in an unexpected moment, in a way that she didn't see coming. Her impact will just be clear, and it'll be so, so worth it.